Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Anantakoti Vaishnav Vrinda Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shikho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasati Gaur Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopina Shai Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai, Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai, Navadvipa Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagatpuri Dhamma Ki Jai, Gangamai Jamuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirvasesis Anivadi Paskatyade Satarane Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchakalpatrubhyascha Kripasindubhyebhyo Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So it is December 7, 2022 in Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 7, The Activities of King Bharata, Text 10. Yatra shama padam yubhayato naba bir drishak chakrais chakranadi nama sarit pravara sarvata pavritrikotari. Yatra.
Yatra.
Where?
Where?
Ashrama Padani.
Ashrama Padani.
All hermitages. Ubayataha.
Ubayataha.
Both on top and below.
Both on top and below.
Nababhi.
Nababhi.
Like the symbolic mark of a navel.
Like the symbolic mark of a navel.
Drishat.
Drishat.
Visible.
Visible.
Chakrai. With the circles.
With the circles.
Chakranadi.
Chakranadi.
The Chakranadi River, generally known as the Gandaki.
The Chakranadi River, generally known as the Gandaki.
Nama.
Nama.
Of the name.
Of the name.
Sarit Pavara.
Sarit Pavara.
The most important river of all.
The most important river of all. Sarvataha.
Everywhere. Pavitri Karoti.
Pavitri Karoti.
Sanctifies.
Sanctifies. Just a moment, Mataji.
Muted. Unmuted.
Srila Prabhupada's translation. In Pulaha Ashrama is the Gandaki River, which is the best of all rivers. The Shaligram Shila, the marble pebbles, purify all those places. On each and every marble pebble, up and down, circles like navels are visible. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Shaligram Shila refers to pebbles that appear like stones with circles marked up and down. These are available in the river known as Gandaki Nadi. Wherever the waters of this river flow, the place becomes immediately sanctified. We have this Sanskrit pavitri, become purified. So the first thing we notice here is Sarit Pravara, the most important river of all, as regard to the Chakranadi or the Gandaki. And this may be surprising because we think the most important river is the Ganga, the Ganges River. Generally, the Ganges, Yamuna, and Sarasvati. And when we call the sacred rivers to enter water, Gange cha Yamuna teva, Godavari Sarasvati, Narmada Sindhu Kaveri, Jale smin sandanim kuru, we don't call the Gandaki at all. So in the mantras for calling sacred rivers, our understanding of the importance of sacred rivers, the Gandaki is not named. And here the Bhagavatam is saying it's the best of all. And this particular instance highlights something that we discuss in our hermeneutics course when we talk about different tools for understanding statements of Shastra, Guru Shastra, and our Acharyas. And that is that sometimes absolute statements are general statements, and there can be some hyperbole. Just like in Sanatana Goswami's Brihad Bhagavatamrita, it keeps telling us who's the best devotee, and there's always someone better than the best devotee. Or we have the descriptions of Rupa Goswami of Dwarka, Mathura, and Vrindavan as being perfect, more perfect, and most perfect. I mean, in English, perfect is an absolute word. You can't be more perfect or most perfect. You can be perfect or not. You can't be pure and then more pure and then most pure. You're just pure. It's an absolute kind of word, like unique. But just like in English, we use the word unique. Uni means one. So the literal meaning of the word unique is there's only one of them. But we will use it kind of loosely. We also use absolute general. We use absolute terms in every language. They're often used loosely. That was the best time I ever had, we said. But is that true? Was it the best time we ever had? Our best experience with the worst meal I ever had? Or he always comes to the temple. He never comes to the temple. Never may mean maybe he comes on, you know, Janmashtami. But always might mean, you know, we see him most days. So these words are used loosely. We use absolute words loosely, and that is done also in the Shastra, quite clearly. It's done by great personalities, by liberated persons. It's also done in the Shastra itself, by the speakers of the Shastra, that they will use absolute terms in a general way or in a loose way as hyperbole. How do we know when that's the case? Well, we know that's the case here because the Chakra Nadi or the Gandaki is not always called the best of all rivers. If it was always called the best of all rivers everywhere by everyone, then we could say, oh, this is simply a statement of fact. But as I said, generally, the best of rivers is the Ganga. Or the Sarasvati, Ganga, Yamuna, Sarasvati. But again, generally the Ganga. In fact, the Yamuna is considered, in one sense, to be part of the Ganga. All right, so I'd like to go on from there and look at the purifying effect of sacred places, pavitri kotari, what sanctifies. And here we have a place that is sacred on two levels. The river itself is sacred, and then within the river there are the Shaligram Shilas, which Prabhupada calls marble pebbles. It's just interesting because the type of stone that Shaligram is different from marble, but some of them are not pebbles. There are some rather large Shaligram Shilas. But anyway, this area, the Pulaha Ashram, is sanctified also because Pulaha Muni lives there. And in fact, much later, much, much later in the story of Maharaj Bharat, Srila Prabhupada says that the reason that Bharat became bewildered by the deer is that he didn't take shelter of Pulaha Muni when he first found the abandoned baby deer to ask for advice, that he was trying to figure it out on his own. And I think it's a safe assumption that there were other saintly persons there at Pulaha's ashram. I mean, Bart was there. Apula Hamuni was there, and there were other saintly persons. So we have Holy River, we have the Shalagram Shila, and we have the saintly persons. So first of all, we might ask, well, why do we need sacred places? And we're going to look at our need for a sacred place. We're going to look at the types of sacred place. And what does the sacred place do for us? What do we mean by it purifies us? What is the means? What is the, like, the mechanism? How does it purify us? So why do we need sacred places? Well, all of our miseries are caused by a polluted consciousness. This fact is not very difficult to understand. I'm absolutely, positively, completely sure that we've all had an experience where we became very upset about something because we misunderstood something. We misunderstood somebody's intentions or their words or their actions, and we became extremely upset. And we were suffering terribly simply because we misinterpreted a situation. And I'm also sure that the same has gone the other way, that people have misinterpreted something we've done or something we've said or some of our intentions and become very upset with us, and it was bewildering to us. Why are you upset? Why are you suffering? So all of our suffering comes from that. Therefore, Krishna says in 6:20, when he talks about samadhi, he says, this indeed is freedom from all miseries that come from material contact. One could say the miseries are objective, adidaivik, adibhautik, adiatmik, just like right now where I am in North Carolina. It's chilly, and it's cloudy, and it's raining. It's just unpleasant weather as far as what a human body has as its ideal temperature. You know, ideal temperature for a human body is like probably about 72 Fahrenheit with a light breeze, right? Sunny out. And so you could say it's a miserable condition for the body. Or you can say, you know, the weather. Or you can say, well, you've cut your finger, you've broken your leg, and that is objectively miserable. Or someone's, you know, other living entity, someone's stolen your money, or somebody, you know, your spouse has cheated on you with somebody else. That's an objective misery. But are these things actually objective? You know, if you're growing crops, you want it to rain. You know, it's, if you want the bugs to die over winter, you want it to get cold in the winter. How is it miserable? Someone stealing your money is only miserable if you thought your money was a source of your enjoyment. And your partner cheating on you is only miserable if you thought your partner was a source of your enjoyment. So many people are cheating on so many people and stealing so much money, and it doesn't affect us because we don't have any investment in it. And you can say, you know, a broken bone or a cut finger is objective misery, but the brain categorizes things as painful only if as an alarm system. There's so much evidence that people can be severely injured and not have pain if there's other circumstances going on. Like on the battlefield, some persons will have their leg blown off and they don't even feel it because the danger of the battlefield is such that their mind is focused on getting off the battlefield, and so their brain doesn't turn on any pain signals from the severed leg. So all of these things are subjective. Prabhupada talks about in teachings of Lord Kapila how Stalin had a surgical operation without anesthesia, because he was able to adjust his mind in a particular way. So all experiences of misery are subjective. And they are all due to the wrong consciousness. Because our natural state as a soul is to be joyful. Brahma-bhuta prasanatma. The soul is naturally joyful. And not just a little bit of joy like we feel in this world when we eat some ice cream or pizza, or we're with somebody we love and at the top of a mountain with a beautiful view, and, you know, not that sort of bounded by space and time limited concept of happiness, but unbounded joy, as Krishna again explains in 620, that one experiences boundless transcendental happiness through unlimited senses, that there's no boundary of quantity or quality or time. So this is our natural state. So our miseries are caused by this wrong consciousness that perceives things in opposite to what they really are. I mean, again, we may know of somebody who is always grouchy and complaining, even though they have so many things in life. Or I've heard people say to me, oh, this such and such happened and I lost everything. I'm thinking, lost everything. Lost everything would mean that you had no shelter, you had no food, you couldn't walk, you couldn't talk, you couldn't hear, you couldn't see. I mean, what is it, lose everything? How often is it that someone actually loses everything? I mean, there are some cases like that, but very rare. I mean, I read of one boy who had a mysterious disease and he actually lost all awareness of the outside world and all control over his body for several years. That's losing everything. You know, but so we think like that. I've lost everything. You know, this is terrible. But we don't see what we have. Right? We've all seen people do this where they so much focus on the negative that they lose awareness of the positives that they have. Perhaps we've been guilty of this kind of thing also, that we forget to say, wait a minute, you know, I can breathe without assistance. I can see, I can hear, I can eat, I can walk, you know, just to have this kind of gratitude. So my point in bringing this up is that it's entirely possible to have innate, inherent, unlimited joy and not to see it, not to be aware of it, to focus one's consciousness instead on another way so that one is miserable. All right, so this is why we need something. We need something to uncover, rediscover, revive, awaken, are the kind of words the Shastra uses, our original spiritual state. And one item that can do this is sacred places. In fact, of the five most potent items of devotional service, Rupa Goswami lists one of them as sacred places. Particularly, he lists the Mathura and Vrindavan area. But the principle of sacred places applies to the Gandaki River as well. It's a general principle. I mean, Rupa Goswami is specifically looking at awakening love for Krishna and Vrindavan, so he's specifically looking at the Mathura area as being one of the most potent sacred items of devotional service. But sacred places in general awaken us to our real self, to our real consciousness. Mm. So let's look at the types of sacred places, and then we can look at how it is that they awaken us and what's the method, how does it work. Well, first, what do we mean by a sacred place? So there are some sacred places that are eternally so, that they appear to be space and time, geographical places, on an earth planet, in this solar system, in this galaxy, but they're not. That when the material world is destroyed, bhutva bhutva praliyate, that they remain. They're never part of this world. So this is called a dham. And a dham, again, it's always here. It may not be very obvious. So there are times when Vrindavan Dham is not very obvious, when it's just, you know, fields. Therefore, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked the Goswamis to excavate the places, find the places, label them. You know, they built temples at different places and so forth. So it would be obvious. But it's still there, obvious or not obvious. Or in Mayapur Dham, Surabhi Kunj is like that. It exists. When Markandeya Rishi saw the destruction of the world, he saw that Surabhi Kunj was still there. It was still existing when all the worlds were destroyed. So that type of sacred place, it's always a sacred place. It appears to be part of this world, but it's not. And sacred places, the other kind of sacred places are temporary, where some place that is part of mundane geography is sacredized, that somebody installs deities there, or saintly persons visit there. There's some spiritual activity going on there, so the place can act as a sacred place, and that's called a tirtha. And a saintly person themselves can become a tirtha. They can become like a walking tirtha. So wherever they go, they themselves are a sacred place. And sacred places are not inert. Sacred places are all persons. Like this Gandaki River, there's a person. Like the Ganga is a person. So actually every ordinary geographical feature has some presiding personality. Every little stream and brook and mountain and type of tree and type of plant, and there's some sort of being, subtle being, that has authority there. Some sort of deva or upadeva, or things, you know, that they have different names in different cultures, you know, fairies and gnomes and elves and whatever they're called. And in every ancient culture, people understood that there are these beings that are in charge of aspects of nature. In Iceland, they're called the Huldufolk, and the Icelandic people take it very seriously. In fact, the government always considers the Huldufolk whenever they construct a road or something like that. There's a very famous garden in the UK called Findhorn, where the founders of that garden and farm are able to converse with these various beings, and they structure their agriculture accordingly. So sometimes there's, you know, deities in charge of a river, like in Hawaii we have, you know, goddess Pele, who's in charge of the volcanoes. And sometimes these personalities actually are not just considered the deity of the place, but are the place. Like the goddess Ganga is considered to be identical with the river Ganga. Same with Yamuna, and Yamuna in one manifestation is the wife of Krishna as Kalindi, and another the girlfriend of Krishna as Vishakha. And so all of these places are persons. And just like we were saying, a person can be a walking holy place, so these persons have the form of rivers or mountains or areas, because they are saintly persons, the place is sacred. And also we have here in the Gandaki the fact that Shalagram Shila is there. Now Shalagram Shila is a natural form of God. Of course, in the modern day, the concept of worshiping even a carved stone is considered primitive and foolish. But what to speak of worshiping just a natural stone? That it's not at all understood. Why would any intelligent person want to just take a natural stone? I mean, people can see, well, if you carve it, if you paint it, then it can represent some higher being. That's the usual understanding of, like, the icons in the Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholic Church. But if you just take a stone as it is, how is it that such can be understood to not only represent God, but actually be God? And our answer is, why not? Maya tatamidam sarvam jagadavyaktamurtinam. And in Bhumira panalobayu kammano buddharevacha, that everything is Krishna's energy, and everything in one sense is Krishna. Everything in one sense is Krishna, Krishna in one sense is everything. Why can't he appear fully in any aspect of his creation? And as we said, every part of creation is, there's some being that's associated with it. There's really nothing that's dead. The concept of matter is really the Lord's illusory energy. And there, in the higher sense, everything is spiritual, sarva kalam idam brahma. And we can understand this very easily in that the universe is the body of God. And as the body of God, although it's a temporary body, still is the body of God. And therefore, the consciousness of God is there throughout every aspect of the universe, even so-called matter. So I always explain that what we call matter is not conscious of itself, but God is conscious of it. And God's not conscious of it, not the way I'm now looking at my computer and I'm aware of my computer, but it's being outside myself, but the way that I'm aware of my hair and fingernails, the part of my hair and fingernails that no longer have living cells, but yet I'm aware of them. I am conscious of them. If you touch them, I can feel them. Of course, if you cut them, it doesn't hurt me, but I'm still conscious of them. So in the same way, the Lord is conscious of the whole cosmos, both the jivas, which are also conscious of themselves, and so-called matter, which is not conscious of itself. So in one sense, the Lord is present in every stone and in every mountain. But the Lord also, particularly personally, is present in certain stones. Now, of course, there's a story behind the Shaligram Shila, which has to do with Rinda Devi and how Rinda Devi was thrown to the material world in a quarrel with Srimati Radharani. And in the material world, she did austerity to get Vishnu as her husband. But Lord Brahma said, well, first you have to marry Sankachuta. So she marries Sankachuta and is a very pious woman. She's very faithful, and Sankachuta is actually a cowherd boy who's apparently taking the role of a demon, and he's invulnerable unless his wife is unfaithful. So Lord Narayan disguises himself as Sankachuta, has a relationship with Rinda Devi, which makes her technically unfaithful. And then Sankachuta is killed in battle. And Rinda Devi is very angry at the Lord. Although she did all her austerities to marry the Lord and she's in love with the Lord, still she's very angry and she says, doing this trick means that you're stone-hearted, so you should become a stone. You should become the stone. And the Lord blesses her that you will become a river. So this Gandaki River is actually Rinda Devi, just like the Yamuna River is the wife of the Lord. So Gandaki River is also the wife of the Lord. Rinda Devi is eternally married to Lord Narayan. And of course, she's also the goddess of the Vrindavan forest. And she's eternally the consort of the Lord. And she is always with the Lord. In fact, it says that the goddess of fortune is sometimes envious of Rinda Devi, because the goddess of fortune sometimes has to go and favor a worshiper. Of course, in one sense, she's always there as the Shriva, as the mark of Shrivas on his chest. But that Rinda Devi, she's always staying at the Lord's lotus feet. So that the goddess of fortune, it says, is jealous of Rinda Devi. Anyway, that's just Leela. But so she becomes the Gandaki River and also the Tulsi plant, and that therefore Shaligram is always worshipped along with Tulsi leaves. So in this way, the natural feature of the area in the Pulaha Ashram is the abode of the Lord and his consort. It's the abode of the Lord as Shaligram Shila and his consort as the Gandaki River. And if you get this image for a moment of that, there is the Lord, there is the stones being washed by the waters of his consort, the Gandaki River, and how pleasing this is to the Lord. So one is actually in the presence of the Lord. Of course, we have a very similar situation in Govardhan, where there the Lord is not just simply some collection of rocks, but the rocks are collected into a mountain. And, of course, the Yamuna does not flow right there anymore, but you have the many kunds. And you have, like, Apsara Kund, which is Srimati Radharani, and you have Radha Kund, which is also Srimati Radharani. So you have the liquid form of the Lord's consort, and the Lord is there as the stone form. And I have a place in Govardhan. And what's very nice about being, I haven't been to the Gandaki, but what's very nice about being at Govardhan is you really get a sense that you're in a temple. I mean, I've been to Sri Rangam and Tirumala, where the temple and the deities are at the heart of the community. They're at the center of the community, and everything in the community revolves around the temple. But if you want to see the deity, you have to go inside the temple. Or obviously in Srirangam, about 340 days a year, the deity comes outside, goes on procession. But in anyway, you have to go out of your home and you have to go to the temple and in the temple to see the deity. Whereas in a place like Govardhan, the deity is this big mountain that is dominating the landscape. And the temple is really the whole community around the mountain. It's like this big temple of apparent nature. So I imagine that the Gandaki with the Shaligrams is a very similar kind of situation. You know, the place where you are is a temple. It's, you know, it's, and it, how to explain it? There's the deity right there. And anybody can come and worship. You don't have to be purified, ritualistically purified, and you don't need to be of a certain caste. You don't need to have a certain kind of education or a certain kind of training, but anybody can just go to the river, can go to the mountain, and there's God. This very accessible form of God, and in a way one can really understand. And there's also, as we're saying, that a tirtha is a holy place one can create. So one can create a tirtha in one's home. Like I have a little room here. I guess you could call it a home. It's much smaller than a home. But I have a shelf. And on the shelf I have, interestingly enough, shilas. I have a Govardhan shila and three Shaligram shilas. And so here has become a tirtha. It's become a holy place. So this place of land... Before having this worship here was just a piece of land. In one sense, everything is already sacred if we have the right consciousness. But in another sense, it's created as a specific sacred place. So one can do that anywhere. Anybody can do that. Of course, to set up a sacred place in one's own house generally requires... If you're going to worship the Lord, it requires that you're properly initiated and so forth. So there's some restriction on that. Of course, as soon as we chant the holy name with attention, the holy name is also the Lord, and we also then make that place into a tirtha. So how is it that these holy places purify our consciousness and bring us to our original natural consciousness? So the word tirtha means a crossing place. Like I lived for 10 years in Detroit, and the word Detroit in French means the straits. S-T-R-A-I-T. So a strait, not like straight and crooked, but a strait is a narrow place where one can cross a river. It's where the river gets narrow. So if they're going to build a bridge, they choose a place where it gets narrow. It's called a strait. It can be called the Narrows, technically. Or you can get from one place to another. Or you can think of a mountain pass, a place where you can cross over a border, where two different worlds, two different sides, two different banks of a river, two sides of a mountain, two different places can be connected. A bridge place. We could also think of it in our modern world like where you can get an internet connection. I was recently at Gita Fest near Orlando, Florida, and my phone company, I must not have very many towers there because it was extremely difficult to get any kind of connection. In the little cabin where I was staying, I could maybe get one bar. It would go off and on, and it depended on like what part of the cabin I walked to, and it was not reliable. If I wanted a connection, then I had to go to the main building, and I had to hook up to their Wi-Fi. And so I had to be in a certain place in order to get a connection. And with that connection, you know, once I had the connection, then I can access people on any part of the planet. You know, so we're all familiar with this. And if I'm in a place where there's no Wi-Fi and there's no cell phone access, then I'm not able to make that connection. So I have to be in a particular geographical location to make that connection. So there are places on this planet, either eternal places like Dhams or created places like Tirthas, where one can make a connection with the other side. An English idiom, we say the other side. When we say the other side, in a general way, we mean after death, or we mean the spiritual realm, or people mean heaven or something like that. I'll see you on the other side, or he's crossed to the other side. So a tirtha is a place where you can connect to the other side. You can connect to the spiritual. It's a literal geographical place, just like we have literal geographical places where you can get an internet access, or a literal geographical place where you can cross a river or cross over a mountain. So this is a geographical place where you can make a connection to the divine. And again, we can create those places. You know, we're not dependent on going to the Gandaki or going to Vrindavan. We can create a tirtha in our home. Just like if you have a phone with a good cell phone connection, you can create a hotspot from your phone so that other people's phones and computers can connect to the internet through your phone. So if a living being is connected enough with the Lord, then they can become a tirtha and they can connect others through them. And we can create a tirtha by having an altar in our home. In fact, the holy places very often are simply beings who are themselves tirthas. Like these sacred rivers, they're beings, they're goddesses generally, you know, that they have this purity so that anyone who comes in contact with them is connected with the Lord. In the case of the Gandaki, we have the Lord himself is there. In the case of Govardhan, also as a stone, we have the Lord himself is there. So they create an access point. Now, because God is in our heart, Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Rajeshir Junatistiti, because God is in our heart, it is certainly possible for the jiva to contact the Lord anywhere, even outside of a holy place. That's certainly possible, not impossible. However, in a holy place, the connection is strong and clear, and it's being amplified by the presence of the sadhus there, in addition to the place itself, which is a being. So the goddesses, gods of that place, are amplifying the signal and making it very accessible to us. Something like, you know, the difference often between a cellular connection and a Wi-Fi connection that's being amplified. So we can also become like that, and we can amplify a connection for somebody else, and we can invite the Lord and his devotees into our home in the form of the deity, in the form of pictures, and then again they amplify that channel of connection. And then what happens with this channel of connection? How does it work? So when we are in a holy place, we are able to perceive reality. Just like you're going over a bridge and you can see the other side. You can see the bank on the other side. It's a narrow place in the river. You're going through the mountain pass and you can have awareness of what's on the other side. I have, you know, my phone. I can see a video or a picture of what's happening in China or Russia or Argentina. Right? I can have, it's almost as if I am there. I'm able to experience the other side. So a tirtha allows us to get some experience of reality beyond our illusion. A holy place takes the theoretical concept of spirituality and makes it tangible. That we actually can, you know, if I just say, oh, Japan exists, but if I can get on my phone and I can talk to somebody in Japan, then I have some experience of its reality. So in a tirtha, I can experience something of the reality beyond my materialistic consciousness. And I can access, at least to some extent, my real position as an unlimitedly joyful jiva. Now, some people have the conception that spiritually potent places or whatever, spiritually potent sounds, places, personalities, objects, force us to have a higher consciousness. But that is never true. The decision as to whether or not to be in illusion or to be in our higher consciousness is always ours. However, making that choice to turn from illusion and turn to a higher consciousness is very, very difficult when you're in illusion and you don't have any awareness of a higher consciousness. Like when I'm deeply sleeping and dreaming, I'm not aware that I'm dreaming. I think my dreaming is reality. And so the option to wake up is not very available to me. However, when my sleep slackens and I have some awareness of the room that my body is in, then the option to wake up becomes much more obvious. When you know that state where you're like half sleeping and half awake and you go, oh yeah, I'm sleeping and I could wake up. So the sacred, whether it's in the form of the holy name, whether it's in the form of prasadam, whether it's in the form of hearing the scriptures, or whether it's in the form of a sacred place, it wakes us up a little bit. And it gives us some awareness. And then we can choose to turn towards it because we're aware that it's there. Without something like, without the sacred coming into our world in some way or another, and one way is through sacred places, we wouldn't be able to make that choice. We wouldn't even know the choice exists. So when Prabhupada says it becomes immediately sanctified, sanctified, pavitra, pure, clean, that one can see. But the choice is always ours. Therefore, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati talked about that many of the people ostensibly living in Radhakund were actually living in Narakakund, in hell. Because although the reality, the highest reality, we Gaudiya Vaishnavas understand Radhakund to be, from Rupa Goswami's Upadeshamrita, the most sacred of all sacred places, one has to absorb one's consciousness in it by choice. I mean, I might be walking over a bridge, but I don't have to look at the other side. I don't have to be enchanted by the other side. I don't have to be interested in the other side. I can be walking backwards over the bridge. I can be looking backwards. I can close my eyes. Therefore, Prabhupada would say, you know, if you want to keep things as they are, if you don't want to become purified, then the process will not be effective. Therefore, we have, you know, there are offenses to the Dham. Just like there are offenses to the holy name, there are offenses to the Dham. Prabhupada talks about, you know, people doing sins in the Dham, thinking, well, I'm in the Dham, so I'm naturally going to get purified. It's not an automatic, mechanical thing that, you know, I go to the Dham and poof, you know, I set up a little altar in my house and poof, purified. But the point is that it gives an opportunity. And these holy places give a very strong opportunity. They give a strong, powerful opportunity of an experience and a choice. And when we engage, when we start to take that choice and we engage in spiritual activities in a holy place, everything is amplified. You know, we say 1,000 times greater the effect of our spirituality. I mean, think of it again in mechanical terms. So when I was in that cabin with a one bar cell phone access, when I tried a few times to call or text somebody, it wasn't particularly effective. I mean, I could send a text, but it might take 10 minutes to go through because I kept losing the connection. It was mostly an exercise in frustration. But as soon as I went to the Wi-Fi area, then I could do anything. Everything was amplified. Everything was enhanced. So the sacred places have this effect. And again, we can create a sacred place wherever we are. We don't need to geographically travel. And that's also another question, is to what extent is it important to geographically travel? To what extent is it important to literally take my physical body and literally move it to a sacred place? Well, especially if we're moving it to a dham. You know, we cannot... Tirth and dham are the same, but not exactly the same. And we can't replicate a dham. We can create a tirtha, but not a dham. So going to the dham certainly has an amazing power. Can, depending on us. You know, again, if we're going to make this comparison to a phone, I got to turn on my phone. The fact that I'm in a place, you know, with full bars and full power, if I don't use my phone, I don't turn on my phone, I might as well not be connected. Everything is being amplified and facilitated, but I still have to make a choice. I still have to choose to access it. But there's definitely something special about going to a dham, and there's even something special about going to a tirtha. Therefore, you know, Rupa Goswami says we should visit a temple of Vishnu every day. You know, and everyone should set up a sacred place in their home and worship there every day. I mean, when we create a tirtha, especially, then whether or not it acts as a tirtha depends on our interaction with that. I mean, I see people who set up an altar in their home and then they neglect it. As a traveling preacher, I've been in many persons' homes with altars. And the thing that strikes me the most is when people put a cloth on their altar and put the deities on top of the cloth. You know, but they don't clean the cloth very often. In fact, the cloth is often of some sort of material that's very difficult to clean. And the cloth may not be clean for a year. So, you know, right, and the deity's clothes may be changed. You know, I was in one person's house where they changed the deity's clothes 4 times a year. Where the deities may not be worshipped regularly. So, you know, you're not really maintaining a tirtha there. It's kind of like if you're going to have Wi-Fi, you have to pay your internet provider. You know, it's not just that you have to have it connected. It's not just like you stick a router in your house and it's going to work. It has to be connected and you have to pay your bill. But most importantly is that we need to choose. We need to actually take advantage of the potency of the holy place. So that we choose. And then it's very powerful. It's very powerful. Advancement can be very rapid and relatively easy in a holy place. So we looked at why we need a holy place, how our consciousness is polluted and all of our miseries are coming from polluted consciousness. We looked at the types of holy places, dhams and tirthas, the personalities of holy places. The Lord is sacred stone, and then we looked at how the holy place gives us access to a higher consciousness that enables us to have a real choice and enables us to use our agency, our free will, to choose wisely. So as is happening with me till the end of January, I am in another class very soon where I'm a student. And so I don't have a lot of time for questions, but I can take maybe one or two. And I see that somebody has a hand up, although I don't know whose hand that is. That's up. Somebody has their hand raised. Yes, does somebody have a question? I mean, I do see that the hand's up.
Oh, darn it. I was talking and I didn't unmute myself. I'm sorry. So you're saying that for a tirtha, it can be created.
Correct.
Whereas for a dham, it's always there. It can never be destroyed. Is that the main point?
Correct. That's not the main point, but it's a point, yes.
Okay. Yeah, because I didn't actually know the difference. You know in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says that I'm not there, what's that? Not Shaham Teshva Vastita.
Everything is in me, but I'm not in them.
Yes.
And then the next verse he says, but everything that is created does not rest in me. And then later on he says, and I am everywhere. So, you know, he's there, not there, and everything's in him and everything's not in him. That's a Chinta Beta Beta Tattva.
So with the Shalagram Shilas, so Lord Vishnu is directly there. But if somebody takes a Shalagram Shila and they say, this is just a stone, then he's not there?
They're not able to access him if they treat him like that, but he's there.
Whereas another stone, if you worship him as Krishna, if Krishna appears there, then it's not stone anymore, it's spirit. But whereas
that's true, we have the deity, yes. Like with the deity, we take a piece of stone and we carve it in the shape of the Lord and we decorate it and we worship it as Krishna. And we ask Krishna to appear in that stone. Otherwise, I mean, Krishna's there in a general sense that it's part of the universal form, it's part of his body, it's part of his energy, but he's not there personally unless we invite him there. Whereas
okay.
The Govardhan Shila and the Shalagram Shila, Krishna's there whether we invite him there or not. They don't have to be installed.
Okay, so in that way, it would be similar like this definition of a dham, always there, can't be created or destroyed. Whereas a tirtha, it can be created by the presence of a saintly person.
And it can be destroyed also.
Okay. All right, thank you. Sorry if I took up too much time.
No, that's fine. You can take one more.
Prabhu's Mataji has to go. Is there anyone else? Did I unmute everybody? Yeah, I did unmute. Anyway,
okay. Irmla Didi Dhanabad, great class. This Gita Fest, this is an annual affair in Orlando?
Near Orlando, yeah, of Russian speaking devotees. And I don't know why they call it Gita Fest. I mean, it wasn't particularly associated with the Bhagavad Gita.
Focused on the
Gita. But it was great.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you.
Well, Mataji, if nobody has anything
else, I can ask a question. It's
yes.
Something that you just touched upon briefly, and therefore I didn't jump right in. We talked about hyperbole and
yes.
How that's used in the scriptures. Someone who, a well-respected preacher, said didn't know how to take it, was that when we read, I mentioned this especially because now we're in the fifth canto, that some of the descriptions of the hellish planets, etc., or the descriptions, are hyperbole.
Maybe.
How do we take that? I always thought we take it literally.
We can understand something's hyperbole, or it's actually a general statement rather than an absolute statement, depending on what's said elsewhere. Just like I said, we know this statement that the Gandaki is the best river must not be an absolute literal statement because there's other things said elsewhere.
Well, what about, for example, if we read about some hellish planets where, let's say, if you've been lusty and engaging in those types of activities, that one has to, the man will have to embrace the red hot form of a woman. It sounds, I don't know if the punishment fit the crime, but do we take that literally?
I don't. Is there any reason why not to? Do we have any other statements, other places that would indicate that it isn't literal?
No, I always accept it as literal. I agree with you.
There has to be some countervailing statement that would suggest that it's not literal.
Can I say something?
Sure.
So in the Bhagavat, the ethics small booklet, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is—it's actually a speech, which I guess he wrote it first, or he spoke it first. It's inconceivable, but in that book, which in context he was speaking with Britishers, Europeans, those who are Bhadralok, who are not accepting Bhagavatam, he pushed that point. So this is where it comes from. I'm sure Irma has read it. It was the ethics, the Bhagavat, the ethics, the three things. Anyway, I have it on the shelf. But so he, one of the things he mentions that is that we shouldn't take that literally, the hellish. He was trying to dissuade people from ignoring the Bhagavatam because of these extreme things, especially that would be the most extreme thing, that the 28 hells and how literally and detailed they're described. So he says that we shouldn't take that seriously. You know, don't let that bother you. That's just hyperbole. He said, more or less says that.
I'm not sure he says it's hyperbole. I mean, he talks about that we can take it metaphorically. But a lot of the scripture can be taken both metaphorically and literally, just like Bhaktivinoda talks about the demons as existing both literally and metaphorically.
But in this that part, in the Bhagavat and its ethics, philosophy, ethics, and whatever.
Yeah, also Bhaktivinoda talks about how you can accept Lord Chaitanya as a great saint if you want, if you don't want to accept him as God.
In that same book, or that's in the Krishnamrita, or the, what is that book?
I don't remember exactly. I don't remember exactly where, but I know that Bhaktivinoda says that.
He's just getting people somehow or other accept Lord Chaitanya.
Yeah, somehow or other accept Lord Chaitanya. If you don't want to accept that he's God, then accept that.
You don't want to accept the hells, at least read Bhagavatam. You know?
Yeah, at least at least accept it metaphorically.
Yeah.
At least, you know, if so I don't see that that necessarily means that it's not literal. It's just saying...
No, in the Bhagavad and its ethics, he doesn't say anything about literally. He specifically just says that it's... Don't take it literally. He doesn't say you have it, that there's both...
I see.
You know.
Well, again, things are very audience-specific. And
yeah.
That's true in the Shastra as well. That's part of hermeneutics. Is that whenever you look at any of the statements of Shastra or any of the statements of anybody to anybody, you always have to take context into account. I mean, just like there's quite a difference between Prabhupada's books and Prabhupada's lectures. So any of us who read Prabhupada's books regularly and listen to Prabhupada's lectures regularly, there's topics Prabhupada talks about in the books that he doesn't discuss at all in lectures. Like, I don't think he talks about Anamoya, Gyanamoya, Vijnanamoya, Anandamoya anywhere in a lecture. At least I don't know of any. And I've heard all of his recorded lectures many, many times. It's, I believe, twice in the books. So there's a number of things Prabhupada talks about in the books that he doesn't discuss in lectures, or he may discuss it very, very little in lectures. And lectures are geared for that specific audience at that specific time. I mean, we all do that.
But I mean, you picked like what I consider not an insignificant example, but a much more significant thing would be the whole hot topic of women and what they do, and they should just stay home and don't do anything, you know, he even writes about it in letters. But then when he opens a school, the girls go, and, you know, the girls go out, says they're equal, they go out, and, you know. But if someone, you know, some people come and they just read the book, they go, wow, this guru is too heavy duty, and this stuff's from 20,000 years ago, we're not going for this program. Then we try to, like, you know, twist in circles to explain, no, Prabhupada wasn't like that. You know, here's a video of Prabhupada giving cookies to all the kids. The girls are not, like, cloistered somewhere, you know.
Yeah, well, that's also true. But, you know, and then if you want to get more specific, if you want to get to a conversation or a letter where it's not just to an audience of 200 or 2,000 people, but where it's to one particular person, then the context becomes even more important. I mean, to me, one of the most significant examples of this is a devotee who asked Srila Prabhupada, what should I do with my mind when I'm chanting? And Prabhupada says, just chant and hear, and what is the question of mind? And that is not the instruction that Srila Prabhupada gave generally about chanting Hare Krishna at all. Not at all. And that particular conversation tends to be quoted as if it's the supreme instruction. And to me, it's like, if I said to you, hey Prabhu, when we're having a conversation, what should I be doing with my mind? What a ridiculous question. I mean, you'd kind of look at me like, are you okay? And you'd say, well, you should be listening to the conversation. Why are you even asking me this? So, the context is important. And therefore, if...
But we're trying to get off the mental plane, is Prabhupada's point.
Yeah, but he was making a point to a particular person who said something very particular. You know, it hit me one time many years later when I was coming back from a program, and this one young man it was his first exposure to Krishna consciousness, and he's talking about Krishna, and I put Krishna in quotation marks, because what he was saying was complete rubbish and gobbledygook, because he didn't know anything about Krishna. And so if I said to him, while you're chanting Hare Krishna, you should think of Krishna, he'd be thinking about Alpha Centauri and Orion's belt or something. I mean, he was just had no concept of Krishna. So if I said, just chant Hare Krishna, just hear the sound, I'd have to say that to him. I couldn't say chant Hare Krishna and think of Krishna. It would actually be a problem. And if he said, should I think of Krishna while I chant Hare Krishna, I'd say, no, just listen to the sound. So it depends on the context. And or an example I give all the time is, because I taught children for so many years, that when you're teaching young children, 5-6-year-old children, you say to them, you can't do 3 minus 5. You just can't do that. It doesn't work. And you'll get out blocks and you'll show them that it's impossible to do that. And you just tell them, you can't do it. You can only subtract this smaller number from a bigger number. But in later mathematics, you tell them you can do it. And in fact, people do it all the time. That's what credit cards are about, where people where they spend money they don't have. So, obviously it's possible. But for the audience, or I would tell children first learning how to write, I would say don't ever start a sentence with because. If they started a sentence with because, they would write something that wasn't a sentence, right? They'd write a fragment. Because I was tired, they would write. So I'd say, you can't start a sentence with because. But you can start a sentence with because. Because I was tired, I went to sleep, you know? Being too young to understand that, I had to give them a rule that was false. But it wasn't false for them. So to say, you can't do 3 minus 5, and you can't start a sentence with because, that's true if you're 6 years old. It is actually true if you're 6 years old. Or, you know, if you say to a young child, you can't have a cookie until you finish your meal. Well, of course you can. And it's one of the first things you do when you're a grown-up, you know, like, I'm going to eat my cookie first. My mommy and daddy aren't here anymore, you know. So it depends on the audience and things. And this is also true in Shastra itself. One has to consider the audience.
But that's what you mean by hermeneutics.
Well, that's one part of
those of us who that's don't one part exactly know what you're talking about.
Hermeneutics is the system that gives you the parameters for understanding how to explain the words of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So there are many principles of hermeneutics given in the Vedas themselves and by acharyas from the beginning of time, and then there are many tools of hermeneutics. So we have an ISKCON hermeneutic system that has identified 24 principles plus an overarching principle and 40 tools and 6 qualities, which when you combine them allow you to explain anything from Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So what I've talked about is a little piece of that.
So that's the course you're taking right after this?
No, that's the course I teach. No, the course I'm taking is in how to create online courses. Because I'm taking our forthcoming book, Career Dharma, and turning it into an online course. And I'm in this very, very intensive course where I'm a student in how to create an online course. And we have, every Wednesday there's a mandatory meeting that we have to go to. And it's very involved. It's the main reason I didn't go to celebrate Kartik in India this year. And, we have Kandita saying in the chat that she saw the Yamadutas and they are real. Yes, many people have seen the Yamadutas. And in fact, I've met other devotees who had near-death experiences and saw the Yamadutas in that state.
But what about the sixth canto where it says Swapne Pipasyanti? They don't ever see the Yamadutas.
Well, devotees who saw them before they became devotees.
Okay.
That's what Kandita's saying when she was 11 years old. So I've also talked to other devotees that before they started practicing Krishna consciousness had a near-death experience and saw the Yamadutas.
So how does the hermeneutics course fit in with VIHE or, like Bhakti Shastri Bhakti? Is it?
Well, we taught the hermeneutics course through the VIHE. Was it this year or last year? I think it was in the beginning of this year. And,
it's online, or
No. Online. We have a YouTube channel where we have the videos are going up gradually, and the materials are publicly available for download on a website. But it's an interactive. It's an extremely interactive course. It's a skill. It's not the kind of thing that you just listen to a lecture. It's the sort of thing that you have to practice. It's like how much are you going to learn about cooking from watching a video? You got to get in the kitchen. So the hermeneutics course is a very interactive course, and but you can get all the materials are free online, and I think we have five or six of the eight classes and video should be on a YouTube channel if you look up hermeneutics, and there should be a link there to the materials. So we've taught it. It's been taught in Russian a couple times, in English it's been taught 3 times.
Several people teach.
Yeah, some members of the Shastric Advisory Council. So usually Radhika Raman, myself, Hari Parshad, Chaitanya Charan, Krishna Kshetra Swami, sometimes Bhakti Vigyan Swami. We had Adi Purusha teach a lesson one time. So different members of the Shastric Advisory Council teach different lessons. I mean, we also have, I know some of our students have gone on to teach it. Prabhupada Priya's taught it twice in a shortened form, where she, I think, just teaches the first 3 lessons. But, I mean, we're happy to teach it again. It just, we don't want to host it. So if somebody wants to host it, in other words, somebody who wants to, advertise it and, manage the advertisement, manage the platform, waiting rooms, breakout rooms, collecting donations, and all that, and vetting the people.
So, Prabhupada Priya lives in Gainesville. She teaches it there. Like, could he take it or something?
Yeah, she hasn't taught the whole thing. She's taught a short version a couple times.
No, I can't handle more than a short version.
But anyway, if somebody wants to host it, and I do have to get going. Okay, Hare Krishna, yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.